entitled this Great Expectations. And the reason is because it's something that obviously they had. They had these expectations of what life was going to be like what was coming. There was a sense that something was going to happen. In fact, we get that today too. We get this sense that things are going to happen. And then, you know, it sometimes happens worse than we thought. Sometimes it happens better and we respond differently. But let's just start by reading the passage this morning from Matthew chapter 2. I'm going to be reading 1 through 12. It says this: After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who has been born King of the Jews? We saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him." When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. When he had called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Messiah was to be born. "In Bethlehem in Judea," they replied, "for this is what the prophet has written. But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for out of you will come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel." Then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time that the star had appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, "Go and search carefully for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me so that I too may go and worship him." After they had heard the king, they went on their way, and the star that they had seen when it rose went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. Well, we see several characters in this story, and I just want to spend some time talking about them. And the first one is Herod the Great. We have too many Herods in the Bible. If you've noticed that, you've run across these Herods and you're saying, "Well, now which one is this?" Well, this is Herod the Great. Let's try and sort them out. And we got to take a little bit of time and go back a ways. About 100 years before this, to Herod the Great's father. This was a time, the time between the Old Testament and the New Testament, 400 or 500 years in there, and it was a tough time. The last thing we read about in the Old Testament is about the Israelites being taken into exile into Babylon. They're there. We've been talking about that the last couple of months. And they leave there and they are released from there miraculously. And God brings a remnant back to Jerusalem. They rebuild the temple and they rebuild the walls. But things are tough. It's not that great there. People are really struggling. Leadership goes in and out. Sometimes they have their own leaders. Sometimes they're ruled by others, other empires. The Persians are the ones that let them go back, but they're still in there for a while. And then the Greeks come, and they're there for a while. And finally, the Romans come. But in between that time, there was a time when they were kind of in control, and they got in a fight with the Edomites. Now, that's nothing new. The Israelites always got in fights with the Edomites. They just never got along that well. And so you had this struggle that was going on. In this particular time, they defeated the Edomites, and they made this rule. They said, "We'll spare you if you convert to Judaism," and a lot of them did. And some of the ones who did were very good. They were political operators. They knew how the systems worked. They were strong leaders. And Herod the Great's father was one of these people. He gained influence in Israel. He was a Jew now, and all the records had been destroyed when they went into exile, and so he claimed he was a hereditary Jew and not really an Edomite, even though that most people kind of said, no, you're really one of those Jews, and kind of held that against him. The other thing he did was he was very good at playing the political game with Rome, and Rome liked him. And he held a lot of influence and power with the Romans as well. Well, he eventually died, and when he died, Rome took care of his son. In fact, the Roman Senate named Herod the Great King of the Jews. That's actually the name that they gave, and we read that already this morning, that's what they were talking about with Jesus. And so Herod the Great became the king of the Jews. He was a strong king. Rome liked him because he kept the Romans' enemies in that part of the world at bay. He was able to do that. He also collected taxes for Rome, and so they thought he was a great guy. He dies not long. We'll come back and talk about him in just a minute. But he dies not long after Jesus is born. They say within 10 years probably. And his kingdom gets turned over to three of his sons. And they have varying degrees of success. And we have two of them here. And the first one I want to talk about is the one on this side. That's Herod Antipas. And he's the one, if you remember the story about John the Baptist being beheaded, that's Herod Antipas. They usually just call him Herod, and so you don't always catch that. But that was Herod the Great's son. Now, the other one I want to talk about is on this side, and not Aristobulus the Fourth, but his son, Agrippa the First. And Agrippa the First, he is also called Herod a lot. And so you see that. And he's the one that we read about in Acts chapter 12 when Peter is imprisoned. He's the one that imprisoned Peter. And if you remember that story, the people pray and they let Peter go. He's miraculously freed, and he goes to the house and knocks on the door, and they don't let him in because, you know, the girl didn't know who he was. Or, I mean, she recognized but forgot to open the door. And that's that Herod, Agrippa the First. And then the next one is Agrippa the Second, his son, and we read about him in Acts chapter 25. This is the guy that Paul, when he makes his appeal to Rome, he's taken to the court of Festus. And Festus is visited by Agrippa the Second and his wife. And so Paul explains and tries to convert him, if you remember that story. This is the guy who said, "Are you trying to convert me so quickly?" And he's also called Herod. So these are the Herods that we see in the Bible. There's just too many of them. But let's go back to Herod the Great. We've already talked. He was able to rule. He was also an incredible architect. He just had a knack for that. And he built all kinds of stuff all over the place. Most of it just to show how good he was. He built the port city of Caesarea, including the port. And if you go to Israel today, you can see the ruins of that. He built the Herodian. And I'm told that if you go to Israel, you'll probably go and see the Herodian as well. He built that as well. But he also wanted to get on the good side of the Jews. He wanted to win them over. Remember, they didn't like him because they didn't think he was a real Jew. And so He did some things. One of the things he did is a couple of times when there was like famine in the land and it was very difficult, he said, "All right, you don't have to pay taxes this year." You know, I would like that, I think. But in spite of that, they still didn't like him. They still held it against him. Another thing he did is he went and he built some things for them, and one of them was the temple. We already talked about how after the exile, the Jews came back and they were allowed to rebuild the temple, but it was nothing like it was before, not near the grandeur. And Herod the Great, he thought, I'll fix it for him. And so he rebuilds it and he makes it magnificent. Not only does he rebuild what was there before, but he adds to the Temple Mount. He adds more buildings on there, and he just does this, and it still doesn't work. The Jews still don't really like him. He also built, he went to Hebron where the patriarchs are buried, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. Remember that Joseph was brought back from Egypt when he died, and he was buried with his forefathers. He goes to Hebron and he builds this complex there over that site. Still, the Jews don't like him. So he becomes this very paranoid and very suspicious individual. He actually murders one of his wives and his mother-in-law because he thought they were going to overthrow them. He murdered three of his sons because he thought they were after him. In fact, it's recorded that the Roman Emperor Augustus said it was safer to be one of Herod's pigs than it was to be his son, one of his sons. Because you had a good chance of dying if you were one of Herod's sons. And this is a guy, in the very beginning of what I read, the Magi come, and they say, we're looking for the king of the Jews. And verse 3 says, when King Herod heard this, he was disturbed. He's not happy about this. He's very upset. What do you mean there's this new king of the Jews? So that's one of the characters in this story. The second one, or a second group, are the Magi. They're not supposed to be here. John says they just got here late. They left a long time ago. We don't know if there's three. That comes because there's three gifts, but that doesn't necessarily mean there was three. They come from the east, we know. They're considered wise men. We don't know how far east. One of the interesting things is east of Jerusalem is Babylon. And if you were paying attention last month, we were talking about Daniel. He was placed in charge of the wise men in Babylon about 400 or 500 years before this. So maybe he had some influence that trickled down over the generations. Some think it was much farther east than Babylon. But these were magi. They're considered wise men. They're considered to be able to interpret signs. They're able to interpret dreams. And this is the reputation they have. They're highly regarded. They would have been astrologers. That's what they did. There was a strong connection between the earth and what happened in the sky, in the heavens. And they thought they were connected. So if you saw something happen that was kind of strange in the sky, you better pay attention because it probably happened on earth too. They named a lot of things, and they had meaning, or they assigned meaning to things. So, for example, Jupiter was considered a royal star. And so when Jupiter would appear, they would immediately start looking around at the different kings, thinking something must be happening. And so this is the kind of thing they did. They see a star. And they connect it somehow to a king and the Jews, and they assume this means there is a new king of the Jews. Now, over the years, people have tried to find out what did the wise men see. Some have said something like Halley's Comet. Well, we can do the math. I can't do the math. People can do the math. And they get back and they say, well, it probably went by around 11 BC. It made a pass close to Earth, which is probably too early. So don't think that was really it. Some have talked about planets converging. We've just heard a lot in the news about that right now. And some say that happened in 7 BC, which is pretty close to when we think Jesus was born. Saturn and Jupiter in conjunction with each other, apparently three times that year. And so people have done this. What was it that the wise men saw? I think it was a miraculous star. I don't think it was just a thing that we see today. It could have been. We don't know. But I think it was a miraculous star. But these wise men are moved enough to get together and spend a lot of money on gifts and to put a caravan together to travel a long distance to go and worship. And so that's the second group of people we see in this story. Now, we also read in history that there was a lot of people in different areas of the world that were expecting a new king that was going to become a world empire. We see that in Rome. We see that in Athens and among the Greeks. We see that even among the Jews. They had this expectation that something was going to happen. And so they're looking for this king, this new king that's going to put everything together. And the third group of people I just want to mention briefly, it's the chief priest and the teachers of the law. You notice in verse 3 that King Herod called the people's excuse me, chief priests and teachers, and he asked them where the Messiah was to be born. They know. They remember what the prophet said, and so they tell him it's in Bethlehem. But what is remarkable to me is we don't read any more about them. That's surprising because they, of all people, would have been looking for this Messiah, this King of the Jews, more than anybody else. They would have been the ones who were just waiting for this. This is what we live for. This is going to come, and we're going to play a big part in that. And we want to make sure at least that we're on the right side of that. But this is all we hear about them. They simply tell King Herod, well, it says he's going to be born in Bethlehem. And that's all we hear about him. So I want to spend the rest of our time this morning just talking about how these groups respond to Jesus. So let's start first of all with King Herod. King Herod heard about Jesus and he tries to kill him. He's antagonistic. He feels threatened by Jesus. Jesus is going to take away his kingdom. It's going to impact how he rules, how he lives. And I think a lot of people today, they wouldn't say they were trying to kill Jesus, but a lot of people find their response to Jesus as antagonistic. They don't want anything to do with Jesus because Jesus threatens their lifestyle. We're afraid that Jesus is going to come in and make us change, and we don't like the C word, do we? He's afraid that Jesus is going to come in and going to change loyalties. Afraid, often we get afraid that Jesus is going to come in and tell us something we don't want to hear. He's going to point out something in our lives that's not correct. And we're going to have to do something different. It threatens our lifestyle. We feel comfortable, maybe. We like the palace that we've built up for ourselves, just like Herod. We like the reputation we've built. We like looking at all the things we've accomplished. And in light of Jesus, maybe those things don't mean as much. And so we hear about Jesus and we want nothing to do with him. The second group, the religious leaders, they heard about Jesus and they're basically indifferent to him. And as I said, these are the ones who should have been the most eager. They're the ones who had the most to gain, but also, this is the Messiah. This is God. You're God's chosen people. You've heard that God loves you since you were little. And now he's come. This should have been a fantastic, wow kind of moment for them. And yet, for whatever reason, they're basically indifferent. And I think that's what the difference is between what we call a personal relationship with Jesus and simply going through the motions. And I think we have a lot of people who, you know, we might feel good about ourselves because we go to church. We might feel good about ourselves because we, you know, do the, you know, volunteer for the right things. We say the right things and we don't say the wrong things. We do all of those things, but when it comes to Jesus himself, it really does nothing to our heart. There's a writer, Donald Miller. He's written some books. One of them was Blue Like Jazz. And in that, he talks about a friend of his. It was a friend who went around and he interviewed leaders of large Christian organizations. And he had a series of questions. But he said he went to Bill Bright. Now, Bill Bright is a man. He's passed away now. He was the founder of Campus Crusade. You might have heard of him. He has just an impeccable reputation. I've never heard a bad thing about Bill Bright. I've heard him speak, and he's not the greatest speaker. He's very humble, and you know he's not gonna get you all fired up. I listened to him right after lunch at a conference, and that was not a good time to put him on. I needed a nap. But I've heard nothing. I mean, this is a guy that has that, you know, Billy Graham type status, you know. And he says his friend walked in there, and one of the questions was, "What does Jesus mean to you?" And he said Bill Bright didn't answer. He couldn't answer. He just was silent for a little bit. And then he said tears started pouring down his cheeks. And he finally got out through the sobs, "Jesus means everything to me." And that really got me. It got me thinking. How would I respond to that question? What does Jesus mean to me? I actually took a piece of paper and I had made a sign with just that question on that I hung in my office. And every time I walked in my office, I would see that sign. What does Jesus mean to me? Because I think it's important that I wrestle with that all the time. It's something that I need to revisit on a regular basis. What does Jesus mean to me? And obviously these religious leaders didn't have that at all. They would have said, "No, it means nothing to me. It doesn't matter." The third group, then, we have the Magi. They found Jesus in an unexpected place, and they worshipped him. Now, when they set out, they were expecting to find Jesus in a palace. We know that. Where did they go? They went to Herod, right? Because if there's going to be a new king of the Jews, where would you find him? In Herod's palace. He didn't know that Herod didn't like the, or they didn't know that Herod wouldn't like this idea at all. So they go to Herod, and you can just think about what they were expecting. Because Herod, remember, is this incredible architect. He's an incredible builder. And I just imagine that his palace would have been magnificent. And they're thinking, okay, we're prestigious wise men. We're coming with all our entourage. We're going to be welcomed into the palace. We'll probably be walking on these incredible marble floors. We'll look around and the room will be decorated just incredibly. It'll have these carvings and, you know, all the stuff that, you know, Herod would have built. Probably covered in gold. And this is the surroundings they would find themselves in. That's what they would have been expecting. But no, they're told, go to Bethlehem. It's a little out-of-the-way town. I was going to put it in the first service, I'll tell you. I put in a name of a little town that I thought would fit, where my wife's from, and I just better not do that since this is live stream. But you can put your own town there. Hicksville. And they go there, and it wasn't a stable. We already talked about that, but it says they found the child with his mother, Mary, to the house is all it says. But it would have been a plain, ordinary house. And I think what would the wise men, how would they respond to that? Would they, is this it? Forget it. And go back? We do that sometimes when our expectations end in disappointment. When things don't turn out the way we expect them to, we tend to run back. We don't tend to check it and see. When we were in Africa, I used to like to spearfish. We did breath hold, so you just put on a mask and fins and you grab your gun and you dive under the water and you find fish down there. And you learn to find places where fish like to go. You look for margins and you look for structure and you find, you know, rock. Just, you know, if you fish from the surface, you do the same thing. But you find those things and you go down and you just, you slowly slide in there and you wait and these fish come along and it's just, I love doing it. And we were always looking for the next hot spot. And we would go down the river and we're looking and we, you know, look, trying to find clues from the surface, what it was like underneath. And we'd find this place and, oh, this looked good. There's got to be some great structure under there. There's probably some good rock piles under there where they have a lot of fish. There's a channel right here. It's going to be great. And we get all our gear on. We dive in, go down, and nothing but sand. And we go, there's not going to be any fish here. Out we go, move on. That's what I would expect. And I think the thing that's really interesting to me is what they do. They bowed down and worshiped him. And that's so different for a lot of us. A lot of people today, they won't do that unless Jesus fits their idea of what he should be. They don't want anything to do with him, and they head the other way. But the Magi have the only appropriate response to Jesus, and that's worship. We're right in that time between Christmas and New Year. Probably some of you have a New Year's resolution already lined up. You know, I have one. I'm gonna lose a pound. I don't want to be disappointed. We're gonna get there. But I think between Christmas and New Year's is a good time to reflect on where you are spiritually. And whether it's that question, you know, what does Jesus mean to you, or what we have, go to the next one. Slide there. How do you respond to Jesus? Are you like these three groups of people? Where do you fit? Are you like the Magi? Is your response to Jesus worship? I want to just challenge you to spend this week reflecting on this question. And then ask yourself, if this is true, if this is supposed to be my response, how are things going to be different coming into the new year? Our Heavenly Father, we just thank you for the assurance that comes from you. We thank you for what you've done for us. We see what you've done. We see that you've showed us the way, that you've taught us. But Father, most of all, we see that you've made it possible for us to be reconciled to you. And Father, I just pray that we would be a people who respond to you the way we should. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.
This has been a message from Gaines Church in Caledonia, Michigan. We'd love to have you join us at one of our Sunday services. Visit GainesChurch.org for more information. One life, one hope, one destination.